Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis, the host of Politics Now. And sometimes it can be hard to cut through all the noise from the Canberra bubble. But on the Politics Now podcast, bursting it wide open is our core business. I'm joined by the brightest minds at the ABC to break down the poly speak and have a chat about what's actually going on behind the scenes. It's called Politics Now, and you can find it on ABC Listen.
From Wandjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap. The US reimposes a naval blockade on the Strait of Hormuz, with plans for new tolls.
On one hand, there are certain things about current events that are totally unsurprising. The rapid escalation on both sides, the president reimposing a blockade, also not surprising. But what's truly gobsmacking is the idea of the US assigning a toll of its own.
That former Middle East ambassador for the US is coming up. Then we'll follow up on the new requirement for universities to adopt anti-Semitism, Islamophobia and racism definitions. The leader of the Group of Eight universities will be here, as too will the eSafety Commissioner with a new report. And finally, we'll pay tribute to a Kiwi cinema legend.
They do move in herds. How'd you do this?
More on the life of Sam Neill coming up. From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, every day there are headline-grabbing developments coming out of the Middle East, particularly around the Strait of Hormuz. We're going to dive into it today because of who we talked to this morning. Barbara Leaf is a former US ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. She also served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. As you're about to hear, she offers a really frank and insightful assessment of what Washington is doing right now. The state of play is that the US President Donald Trump says he'll reinstate a blockade of Iranian ports. He'll also impose a 20% charge on all cargo shipped through the strait. Speaking to Fox News, the president said that military action would continue.
So we're just going to hit them very hard, and we're going to keep the strait, and we'll probably run it. We'll become the guardian of the strait. Maybe we'll call it the guardian angel of the strait. And we should be reimbursed for that. When we do that, we're going to be reimbursed because the other nations are very wealthy. They're on our side.
U.S. President Donald Trump there. Iran has declared it won't let the U.S. interfere in the management of the Strait of Hormuz and continue to target U.S. military assets across the region. So this morning with Sally Sara, Ambassador Barbara Leaf got into what Washington was doing and why there are real concerns about its strategy in the Middle East.
On one hand, there are certain things about current events that are totally unsurprising, and that's the rapid escalation on both sides, use of military force, sort of a standoff. The president reimposing a blockade, a naval blockade on Iran's ports, also not surprising. But what's truly gobsmacking is the idea of the U.S. Assigning a toll of its own of 20% to ships passing through, or is it to the states of the Gulf? It wasn't clear from the president's comments when he said those countries are very wealthy. I had the uneasy feeling he was thinking about somehow assigning that toll to the Gulf states themselves, which, as we know, have borne the brunt of the damage from the war.
Is this even doable, Barbara, this kind of toll?
Well, it's an enormous tie down of U.S. military assets. So, you know, folks have talked for months now inside and outside the government of the U.S. forcing the strait open. Well, you can force the strait open and take casualties and so forth, but how do you maintain it being open? That's an entirely different matter. And that's not only an enormous commitment of U.S. military assets in a region that is already got more than its share of U.S. military assets. It's also a great risk. So, I think it's not really tenable.
What do you make of the tempo of the current military strikes from both Iran and the United States? Are these happening under a mutually understood ceiling? Are we below all-scale, all-out war at the moment?
Well, we're still below a certain threshold. And it is, in a sense, controlled escalation. But it's the kind of thing that can get into uncontrolled escalation. And the thing that puts Iran, the factor that puts Iran at an advantage, unfortunately, is that they can simply continue to resort to horizontal escalation, which is to say they don't so much go after the U.S. or U.S. forces, they go after Gulf states, as they did in the last several days, Bahrain, Kuwait, UAE, even Jordan. So that's where, again, these states take the brunt of the damage, and that's pretty hard.
All the while, Barbara, the clock is ticking on this 60-day period of negotiations. Can the parties come back to the table in a meaningful way in this period?
Well, yes, they can. I mean, diplomacy is always something that is available and that one should think to resort to, especially when the military tools are of diminishing utility, as they are now. As I say, the Iranians have, as an asymmetrically imbalanced power, then, in other words, the U.S. and U.S.-Israel certainly can overmatch the Iranians in conventional military power. But we've seen the stark limitations of achieving strategic goals from the air from standoff strikes. In fact, the U.S. has not achieved any strategic goals. It's had tactical successes. So even in this somewhat fraught atmosphere, yes, the parties can return to the table. And that's, in fact, what a number of mediators, especially the Qataris, are attempting to achieve right now.
Barbara, just briefly, the bigger picture, what sort of conversations are happening in places like Washington, D.C. about the reality of asymmetrical conflict? What's been seen between Ukraine and Russia, for example, and now the U.S. facing its own example with the way that Iran has managed to stay in this conflict?
Well, I think on the one hand, it was clear from the Istanbul NATO summit and the president's, not only his engagement with Ukrainian President Zelensky, but also the really dramatic pivot he did on assistance to Ukraine, including the notion of permitting Ukraine to manufacture U.S. Patriot systems itself. So on the one hand, he has clearly been impressed by Ukraine being a winner, in a sense, you know, winning on the battlefield, but with the same tools that are proving quite relentless and difficult to counter by Iran in a different battlefield. So I'm not sure that the president has connected those dots precisely. Certainly military planners have, but there's not a good answer at this point. And that's why I say, ultimately, diplomacy is the place that this is going to have to be settled.
Barbara Leaf there, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. She also served as the Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. Australian universities are being required to adopt definitions on anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and racism. It's part of this overhaul on higher education standards being rolled out by the federal government. We started looking at this story yesterday, hearing from the government and the federal opposition, but today we wanted to hear from the university sector who'd be implementing this new standard. It comes as students and academics have been recounting pretty awful experiences of anti-Semitism on university campuses. It's part of the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, and its focus on the tertiary sector this week. At the hearings this week, Jewish Australian woman, Liat, shared her experiences of escalating anti-Semitism in the wake of the October 7 attacks on Israel.
I had people perform Nazi salutes in my direction. I was called a baby killer and a genocide supporter, and no student should be subjected to these sorts of behaviours.
Clearly, there is plenty to talk to the university sector about. So this morning, Sally spoke with Vicky Thompson. She is the chief executive of the Group of Eight Universities.
What will these new anti-racism governance standards, what will they look like in practice for universities?
Well, there's two issues here. There are the governance standards, which the government is introducing, and then there's the requirement for universities to have a definition of racism, and sitting under that, a definition of anti-Semitism, Islamophobia and racism directed towards First Nations people. And so the government hasn't been prescriptive, if we just talk about anti-Semitism at the moment, the government hasn't been prescriptive in which definition of anti-Semitism we adopt, but I would suggest that there are two that are floating around, and that is the what's commonly known as the IHRA definition, the International Holocaust definition, and the definition which was actually developed in the first instance by the Group of Eight after a request from the Special Envoy to combat anti-Semitism back in 2024-25, and then was adopted in principle by the broader sector. And from our perspective, different universities obviously are doing different things, but all of our universities across the Group of Eight, and they're the only universities that I can speak to, have adopted either of the IHRA or the now Universities Australia definition, or embedded it into policies. What the government is doing is saying, well, embedding it in policies is probably not the standard. You actually have to have a definition that is not only symbolic, but is also able to be used in a context of, you know, complaints, et cetera, and operationalised, if you like.
And what's the timeframe here for these definitions and practices to be implemented?
Fairly quick, but notwithstanding the fact that I think a lot of work has been done across the broader sector, but certainly across the Group of Eight universities. So we have to have them in place by the 1st of January 2027. There is clearly an issue, and we've heard some fairly harrowing evidence yesterday in the Royal Commission. And so there's clearly an issue in public confidence in our institutions, and that is not acceptable from our perspective, and we need to do better. And that's why we are trying to do better as we can, working with government and also our own institutions, putting in place different measures.
University campuses have long been the site of demonstrations. How are universities going to manage this in the future if groups have opposing views on a situation that is unfolding globally? Will things like encampments be allowed in the future?
I'm not sure you'll see a replication of the encampments that we had post October 7, and actually since that time. And one of the things that we did, Sally, after the horrific Bondi attack, was established an expert committee, an independent committee led by Dr. Alan Finkel, Australia's former chief scientist and also obviously former chancellor of Monash University. And they undertook a really deep dive into, you know, what had gone wrong for our universities in particular, where had we been caught short-footed. They found that a lot of work had been done, but there were a lot of complexities as well. So different universities had different bylaws, different complex, you know, federal legislation, state legislation. And so that's not to cast the blame of anything that happened on anyone but, you know, our own universities. But it did show that it was a very complex sort of environment we were in. Universities, as you quite rightly say, are places where we have to have contested and open debate, but that doesn't mean it's harmful debate, and it can't be directed towards people in a way that causes the harm that it has.
And that is the boss of the Group of Eight Universities, Vicky Thompson. What do you know about the term sextortion? It's a pretty heinous practice involving blackmailing a victim with nude or sexual images. And in Australia, it's on the rise, with more than half of those surveyed in a new report experiencing it before the age of 16. The report comes from the eSafety Commissioner. It's part of a series they do looking at issues, particularly around child sexual exploitation and abuse, and what the big tech companies are doing about it. This latest report says that there are significant gaps in the way they're tackling these problems. Some platforms are failing to provide clear and accessible ways for users to report abuse, while others are lacking key detection tools to prevent harm in private messaging and video services. Julian Mangrant is the eSafety Commissioner. Sally asked her if, looking at the reports over the months, if she was seeing any improvement from the big tech companies.
We actually have seen some glimpses of light, and this is why we keep putting out these transparency reports, but holding their feet to the fire, pointing out weaknesses and shortcomings, and using that reputational lever to have them improve. So 5 years ago, when we did this first study of about six companies, Microsoft was the clear laggard. It took them up to 19 days to deal with reports of child sexual abuse on Skype in particular. They had no technology detection. They were embarrassed, frankly, by it. Some of their executives called me in. I said, well, why do you even have Skype anymore if it's being used this way? They actually ended up deprecating the service, which means they got rid of it because they did find it was more risk than reward for the company. And now they're actually using some technical detection tools on platforms like Xbox. We need to see them expanding that to Teams and other video sharing platforms, because live stream child sexual abuse is a horrible crime where, you know, children are often exploited by their families in developing nations. And unfortunately, Australians and Western consumers are driving that demand for child sexual abuse online.
You've also outlined the concerns about what's known as sex torsion for young social media users. Has there been a reduction in that, or is it continuing to grow?
Sexual extortion is reached catastrophic proportions, I'd say, with Australian boys and young men being brutally targeted by organized criminal networks every day. These offenders are exploiting these very predictable weaknesses in platform design. They're able to continue doing it with reporting pathways that are either non-existent or hard to find. You know, these advanced tech companies are using inconsistent safety tools to move quickly and just to provide reporting, which is not a big fix, using language analysis technologies. We've provided them scripts of the typical grooming messages that sextortionists use. They could use the language analysis to get rid of the fake and imposter accounts. But we're also seeing the organized criminals become much more sophisticated. They're using generative AI to create very attractive personas. They're using face swapping technologies, which are very convincing, and voice cloning technologies. So, you know, they've really honed their craft in terms of targeting young men. I just did the numbers for last fiscal year. We had 8,000 image-based abuse reports last year. That's the non-consensual sharing of intimate images and videos. And traditionally, the first 8 years of that service, it tended to be women and girls that were targeted with the non-consensual sharing of intimate images. 50% of these reports are now financial sexual extortion targeting young men between 18 and 24. But we're also seeing much younger kids coming to us, 15, 16, 17. There's a manifesto that shows these organized criminals how to put high-pressure tactics on to isolate the young people and to panic them to get them to pay. It's a horrendous crime that, you know, in the worst case scenario, leads to extreme mental distress and sometimes suicide.
What's the latest dashboard on the effectiveness of the under-16s social media ban, which the federal government is looking to strengthen?
Well, we will be coming out with a compliance report in the next month. We've actually seen a 37% reduction in the number of children under 16 having and holding accounts. But as we've been very clear, the social media companies are not complying. We're calling them out on their poor practices, and we've seen some of the companies improve them, but we need to lift compliance. They are trying to give us the enforcement tools that we need to hold these companies to account. There is an inquiry happening, which we will, of course, submit to. But, you know, this was always going to be an iterative process. You know, we're the first one in the peloton, no one drafting behind us quite yet, and we're learning as we go. Once we get some of these tools, I think you'll see some action. We've also seen with countries all over the world joining this fight, it's a really important global pincher move. So many of these companies have the market power of nation states, so we need to be banding together, you know, the 27 countries across Europe, and we will see progress over time, but this is a major normative and cultural change. This is not going to be an overnight success. We're trying to undo 20 years of deliberately engineered harm to keep kids on their platforms.
Julian Mann-Grant, the eSafety Commissioner there, speaking with Sally Sara on Radio National Breakfast. He really was one of the most recognisable faces on both sides of the Tasman, and often Hollywood would come calling for his services. Sam Neill's acting career spanned decades and genres.
When you think about it, it's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yes, it is amazing. Perhaps with time, you might come to like me.
What are you doing?
Oh, nothing much, just sitting around, thinking about you.
I thought we should get married.
Well, what a handsome proposal.
Did you get any food? What the hell is that?
Salad.
You were right to want your freedom, and I'm glad that you have it.
Thank you, sir.
That is some of the remarkable showreel of actor Sam Neill. He died yesterday at the age of 78. In 2019, he was awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Australian Academy of Cinema and Television Arts, and it was presented to him by his longtime friend, the great Australian director, George Miller. He joined Sally for an interview today and said that he was really shocked by the death of his friend.
Because he was doing really, really well. So many of us felt it because it's Sam, because he was such an exemplary human being. We saw him as an actor and we got to know him as an actor. The world did. But what was so amazing about him is that he was comprehensively an amazing person. I mean, it's a big loss, of course.
George, you've worked with many Hollywood actors. What did it tell you about Sam Neill's character that away from the camera, it seemed to be that he craved a very simple and genuine life right on the other side of the world from others who were waiting for the next audition and worrying about their career? It seemed to be a very different life for him.
I found that the case with all the best of the actors I work with is that they have what Sam has. In other words, he lived life very, very fully. Mm-hmm. Basically with an enormous amount of wisdom. But he was wise in not only what he said, but in what he did. His conversations, I still remember them, I mean, about anything. Mm. But it was always, again, as I said, reflected in his actions. He was really special. He had significant influence on Australian cinema. We're hearing it from all over the world about how great a person he was, as well as being a great artist, actually.
With your collaborations, what did you learn about film from Sam Neill, do you think?
I think I'd say the biggest thing is the way that he found a way to work with those around him under any circumstance and bring out the best, not only in himself, but all those around him. And he was just a great collaborator and a deep understanding of life. And did it all with, as so many people have said, with an enormous humility. So he had a big influence on all of us who worked with him, I'm sure.
And that is the great Australian director, George Miller, talking to Sally Sara about his friend, the late Sam Neill, who's died at the age of 78. Well, thank you so much for listening to all of those interviews produced by the Radio National Breakfast team. The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Shannon Schubert and Brooke Young. Of course, you can get more coverage on the life and legacy that Sam Neill leaves on ABC iView, also ABC Listen. It's worth checking out Fran Kelly's interview on the Radio National Hour with Sam Neill's longtime friend, Heather Mitchell. That's it from us today. I'm Lucas Dundon. We'll be back with you tomorrow.